The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
Hey, everybody. Thanks again for showing up for the Jay Young Show. We have a great show for you today. Alex Kowalski, friendly Tiger member of my good friend here in Wisconsin. And we're going to learn more about him and about what his journey was like. And you know, I kidded a minute ago about how easy it is, you know, to be successful in business. And, you know, it's not easy, man. The top, 99% of the people, you know, don't ever get there. I mean, it's a hard journey. And what did you have to do during that journey? That's kind of what my message is all about. That's why I want to bring that to you. You know, I want to bring that to you, the consumer, talking about, hey, how easy is it? How hard is it? What did you have to learn? What did you learn? What was the easy things? What were the hard things? What was the big takeaways? You know, what is it that you had to do? I mean, not everybody can be a Jeff Bezos, right? And start a little company and all of a sudden grow and build. And next thing you're worth $200 billion or whatever it is, or a Walmart or something like that. But Alex, thanks for coming on the show today. Thank you.
Thanks, Jade. Looking forward to spending some time with you and talking a little bit about our story up here in Wisconsin. Right now, the only thing anybody cares about is Aaron going to play quarterback or not? So,
that was my second question, but I heard that he thought about it over the fourth, and he's like, okay, now I'm ready to concentrate on football, and I guess everybody's going to figure out if he's going to be quarterback of Packers or where, right?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, his life doesn't look too bad playing golf on the weekends on television and stress-free. I don't know why he'd want to come up here. Maybe 30 million reasons to do it, but we'd love to have him back in Green Bay. It'd be a great fall if we have him.
Wow. So no inside information on that?
No, not in my new life. I'm not a quality assistant coach in Green Bay for sure.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Well, I mean, I read an article. He was talking about, you know, the double jeopardy or the jeopardy, being the Jeopardy host. And well, I only play football X number of weeks a year. And Jeopardy's only like 16 weeks a year or whatever it is. I could do it all. And it's just it's great to be in that arena, I guess, and have that type of whatever he could do. But, man, I tell you what, he's keeping a lot of people on pins and needles right now, isn't he?
That's right. There's a lot of people depending on him up here.
Yeah. I went to a game up there a couple of years ago on a Monday night football, and it was incredible.
Yeah.
Great. I mean, the atmosphere there is just really, really cool. And it is everything that you think it is. And it wasn't but like 40 degrees, so it wasn't like a real cold, but I can imagine how cold that stadium is.
Yeah, and we'll get into my story in a minute. I'm not a native Wisconsin guy, but ended up here 20 years ago after college. And from a non-diehard Packers fan, can tell you it is absolutely electric. And, you know, it's a city. People have a hard time contemplating. It's a city of 100,000 people. We had an NFL franchise. I mean, Green Bay is 100,000 people, you know, owned by the town, owned by the community. It's got a CEO running it. So the story, the uniqueness, you feel that passion on game day, the tailgating, being in the stadium. It, again, from a non-Packers fan, absolutely bucket list thing. You got to do it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It really is. And all the tents that are set up all the way to the deal, and went there and had what they eat before bratwurst or something?
Bratwurst. Yeah.
In every imaginable flavor you can imagine. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Jalapeno cheddar, mushroom Swiss brat. If you can dream it up, they can make it here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Really, really great. Okay. So tell me something about, where did you go to high school? Where were you?
Yeah, so I grew up in lower Michigan, a little town called St. Louis. So just south of Mount Pleasant, an hour north of Lansing, which is the capital. My parents were both public school administrators. Grew up, I had two brothers. It was a rough and tumble household. We all played sports. We ran everything. But because my dad was a superintendent, I had to get good grades at school. And the message from my parents growing up that I remember was, hey, go to college, you know, get good grades, get a good degree, and go get a good job, and life will take care. That's how we were raised. That's, you know, was our household was growing up. At a young age, though, I had started one business. It was a lawn mowing and landscaping business. My grandfather died when I was in sixth grade, so I inherited a John Deere lawnmower, ride-on lawnmower. And so, you know, what do you do, right? You get one of these, and here it is. And I was going to cut the neighbor's grass. My brother helped me, and then my other brother joined. And one thing leads to another, and 22 lawns and some commercial contracts. I had to get a driver's license in there somewhere. So it was a great business, and learned that working for ourselves was something we enjoyed, and how you grow it. Again, back to the napkin before social media, but the work ethic was instilled in us. So I kind of always stuck with me. Went to college up at Michigan Tech, which is way up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and got a degree in chemical engineering and a degree in business. I also played football there. It's some great fond memories of my time being a college athlete. Met great friends, some of my best friends to this day still. And that will actually come back in the story later on. And we'll talk about that. But after that, I moved to Wisconsin. It was 2001. The dot-com bubble had burst, and the auto industry was in shambles in lower Michigan. And so I said, oh, we'll go to the paper industry in Wisconsin. We're going to need paper for forever. So 2001, I came down and started my career with International Paper, a Fortune 30 company. Wow. Everything I thought I wanted, the pension, the 401k, 2 weeks of vacation, and I was on the corporate train.
Wow. So why did you decide chemical engineering?
Yeah, I had a chemistry teacher in high school that I loved and just loved it. And so I thought, again, 16, 17-year-old kid, hey, love chemistry, go be a chemical engineer. I was really good at math and science. And, of course, the financial side of me was I looked it up. Hey, chemical engineers, you know, 99% placement rate. They and electrical engineers were the highest salaries coming out of school. So it just made sense.
Wow. That's neat. I mean, I know that some of the brightest people that I know got a chemical engineering a degree. I mean, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your, I'm just saying that, man, some of the smartest people have a chemical engineering. And obviously you're extremely bright. You've done a great job in your business and growing it and selling it at the right time. But I'm just saying that, man, that's a great that you thought to get that degree, because that gives you, not only gives you common sense, which I've found with people chemical engineering, that it does give you common sense, but it also gives you a great part of knowledge that some of the people don't get from that engineering standpoint. You know,
yeah, so I told people I was a solid B student, right? And it was hard. I didn't get into the organic chemistry, but it taught you how to solve very complex problems. I think that's really, you know, to piggyback on what you said is, yeah, you know, there was a lot of multi-step, you know, amorphous information. You had to solve for it. And then along the way, I actually got a business degree as well, Jay, because I redshirted my first year for football. I was done with my chemical engineering degree in 4. And so I got a business degree along the way as well, and found, it's kind of funny how the world works, I found I enjoyed the business concepts. I love the problem solving of chemical engineering, but I enjoyed the business concepts and how to impact the organization at a higher level than just, you know, looking at a pump curve or drawing out a distillation column. So that's kind of where the journey started.
That's great. I mean, it is. I definitely agree with that. Okay, great. So you graduate from college athlete, you graduate from college, you go to IP, and then all of a sudden, how long were you there?
Well, I ended up being there 2 years, but 6 months in, I was like, wait a minute, this isn't what I signed up for. This is not the go to school and get a good job. You know, I saw what my boss was doing and my boss's boss, and, you know, up the food chain. I thought, this is not what I want life.
Maybe in 40 years, 30, 40 years, you're going to be, you got to where you can at least afford the best house. And
right. Stock options, maybe if you were there 30 years and, you know, maybe a gold watch on the way out. And so I think part of it, just being impatient, being driven, some of the background, you know, the way I was raised. And so, you know, as every great story goes, I meet a girl. Right. And so 6 months in, I met my now wife, Holly, and I was out in the town, and one of the summer interns that we had at the mill at International Paper, it was his birthday. So we all went out celebrating, and I met Holly at the wee hours of the morning. And that's the story we're not going to tell during this interview. But she and I started dating, and I was just drawn to one, her beauty. But she had left Kimberly Clark. Same story. College athlete, got a degree, went to Kimberly Clark, again, Fortune 100 company, left, and she had started her own business. And she was about a year into that journey. And I just couldn't believe it. How do you leave this great job? I was not loving what I was doing, but I didn't know how to go start your own thing. And so she and I meet, and it become a moment that, you know, just a random birthday party out in the town and sort of changed the trajectory of both of our lives. She ultimately sold her first business in 2004. It was a graphic design business. We met in late 01. We get married. And I went and did a couple of other things along the way. Jay, a headhunter called me after 2 years at IP, and I went and worked at another large company, did some sales. But it really took another turn when I went and worked for a startup in about 2006. Up north in the northern part of Wisconsin, it was a real estate investment firm. And that was kind of my first opportunity. I was a director of sales to get the business side of it. How do you finance commercial property? How do you grow a small business? And Holly had had her exit behind her. She had started up her second business and we were on our way. So yeah, those are sort of the early beginnings of how I made the shift from the corporate world to entrepreneurs.
So you get into welding, right? So performance welding,
right?
How does a chemical engineer get into welding and build a business up? We're on pins and needles trying to figure out how did you build this business up and sell it. So that's right. Kind of the idea behind.
So it's a great lead in. So Holly and I, you know, we started investing, doing some commercial real estate deals. You started a second business. And we're just kind of, I'll say, just ham and egging it. Another, you know, game day term, right? Just kind of ham and egging it. And a banker called me because I like to network and build a bank. A banker said, hey, I just met with an owner of this welding business, and it's a distressed company. It needs capital. It needs leadership. He was like, oh, I know you're always looking for things. You should go meet him. And so that's exactly how it started. I sat down with the owner and his wife, hammered out a deal. I'll never forget. I called my parents, and my dad goes, a welding company? The hell are you buying a welding company? You don't know how to weld. And the key, there were real people. Said, why'd you buy it? There were three things. And I think this is great. You know, I learned this in the hard way, but we can buy it right. It was 2012, Jay. So we're post recession, 08, 09, the horrible recession. And the banks were still cleaning up some of their hardest hit credits, bad balance sheet, right? They needed it gone. The regulators wanted it off their books. It was their largest non-performing credit. So, you know, you had a willing seller, eager seller, if you will, and a willing buyer. So I could buy it really right.
All right.
Number two, I had a guy to run it. My best friend was a former teammate of mine in college. He was a linebacker. I was a quarterback. So we had the offense and the defense came back together. And he had spent 10 years running plants in this space, contract manufacturing, cutting, bending, welding, painting, assembling. So he knew how to run the plant. Matter of fact, this business was far smaller than the plants that he was running. Called him up. We essentially hammered the deal out over the phone, put together an email. That was our big employment agreement where he was going to help grow this and be incentivized along the way as well as on the back end. And third, probably the right order, you buy it right, right guy to run it, amazing customer list. Miller Electric, ABB, MassTruck, did these great global customers for a little $8 million business in Little Chute, Wisconsin. And I just thought, wow, if I can buy this right, I got the guy to run it. We got to be able to talk to these folks and help, you know, make their lives easier and grow it. It was that simple. That was really how it started.
Wow. So you just were looking for a business at that time, 2012. I mean, I know we went into 2004, yep. 2006, and then we jumped to 2012. Pardon about that. My bad on that. But you found the business. And about how much did you pay for it?
Yeah, so we bought the company for $3.2 million.
Okay.
And what that included was they had 90,000 square feet of manufacturing. They had two buildings, 60,000 in one town and 30,000 about 8 miles down the road. Because we had done enough real estate along the way, that was kind of my downside protection. I thought the real estate, just the two buildings, were probably worth between $2 and $2.5 million between them. And so, you know, between the equipment in the business, the receivables, a little bit of cash on the balance sheet, we really got the business for about 70 cents of orderly liquidation value. And again, values of 2012, not today. Those buildings today are worth far, far more than that. But in those days, it was still a very slow, you probably remember, a very slow recovery out of what was a very deep recession. So we financed it. And this is where you get to the tiger. This is how we talk. We had saved up $400,000 of cash. Okay. So we financed $2.8 million. And the same banker who referred me to the deal is the one who financed it. So if he wasn't crazy enough to refer to me in the first place, he doubled down and actually lent us $2.8 million to do it. But he believed in us. And he, to this day, he's a very close friend of mine. And he says when you're small business lending, which is what they do, they bet the jockey, not the horse. And so he believed in what we're going to do, bring the right management team in, right guy to run it. And he believed in us. So first 2 years, I didn't take a salary out of the business, Jay. I mean, it was a grind. It was, we turned it profitable the very first month. We closed one plant and we brought everything under one roof. Holly and I leased those. We owned the buildings outside of the operating company. So we leased that plant out to another tenant, which worked out great. And then just worked hard on lean manufacturing, trimming down our customer list. The quick short story is the day we bought $8 million in revenue trailing 12 months with 230 customers. The day we sold it, it was a $30 million business with 10 customers.
Yeah, right? I remember that. We talked about this about 3 or 4 months ago. So now go over those numbers again with me, because that was very, very important.
Yeah,
don't ask you, dig in a little bit.
The day we bought it, it was really a job shop welding business, right? And they would say yes to everybody. So it was $8 million in total revenue, not making money, right? It was losing money with 230 customers. In the first 90 days, we got rid of 100 customers. Just out of the gate. But the tail of the road is, it's the 80-20 operating philosophy, right? 20% of your customers give you 80% of your revenue, right? 20% of your customers, 80% of your profit. And it's a universal principle, and we believe in it. We implemented it. And live and breathe it. So we trimmed it down. We got closer to our best customers and said, what are you not getting from your current suppliers that you'd like to see, right? So we grew with them, and every year we grow a little bit more, trim off a few more, grow a little bit more, trim off a few more. And I could go back and dig the data, but I think in 2 years we were down under 30 customers after the first 24 months. And that's what we did. And ultimately, you know, as the economy really grew in 15, 16, and 17, a lot of it was actually one of our customers was in the fracking, you know, supply to the fracking business, and they were growing as oil shot up. And so, we kept doing more and more for our biggest and best. And as we did, we would get rid of the noise. And so what happened is our margins got better, right? Every time you do that, your margins get better. We didn't add any overhead. We just grew. We implemented robotic. Well, there's a lot of operational things that Rob, my business partner, brought to the table. Put our own powder coat system in, did a lot more value add. We did assembly. We were building whole zero turn lawnmowers by the end, entire pieces of welding equipment the company wasn't doing when we bought it. So
Alex, wait a minute now. Okay. So you buy the business, it's doing $8 million with 230 customers, and then you start turning business away.
Right.
I mean, how can you do that? I mean, it's like, I'd be freaking out so much and going, I'll do anything for anybody imaginable. Right. Just bring it to me. I'll do it. You know?
Yeah.
So, how did you think, okay, now we need to go to, $10,000 minimum ticket or something. I mean, there's gotta be somebody there that said something. Who was it that came up with that?
Yeah. So the 80-20, I mean, it's a universal principle, but locally there's one of my mentors and great business heroes is a man named Mike Weller. Mike ran what was Miller Electric. It's now ITW Welding. And Miller went from a $200 million privately held family business that, single digit margins to $1.8 billion with 30% gross margins, right? He is a master at 80-20. He's a mentor of mine and a great friend. And so it's hard to think about that, especially in a turnaround when that was the leap of faith, if you will, for me to borrow $2.8 million to pledge your house, everything that you have, and take 100 customers out of the equation. But what we found, Jay, is by taking 100 customers, I don't remember the exact number, it was like $50,000 in revenue. It was just noise in the business. And so what our employees, the way they rallied around this, I'm kind of switching from the business strategy to how it felt as an operator, we were running overtime. We'd make parts bad. And it was always that one-off part that we only got the order for once a year, or that customer that just, it was like $3,000 in revenue, but they just complained all the time. Or it was a part that our equipment couldn't manufacture, but someone had bid or quoted and said, oh, we can do that for $5. So really what we did, we call it weed the garden. But we took the noise out of the business. And so we did that. The revenue went down fractionally, but holy cow, the resources that we freed up, our scrap went down dramatically. We started buying fewer, they had all kinds of inventory laying around of stuff that they never made because they would buy in bulk and then only make for one order, right? There's a lot of sort of bad business principles. So it's a leap of faith. I grant you that when you put your whole life savings at risk to start turning away business. But operationally, when we did that, that's what freed up the capacity to bring the other plant under one roof and to get our team focused on our best customers.
Wow, that's great. That's a great thought. Really, really is a good thought. So I mean, I'm just like, trying to figure out, because you quadrupled sales. I mean, you went from from 8 million to 30 million in a few years.
Yep.
And all of a sudden doing it with less customers.
Yeah. And some of our better numbers, I think after a year, I'd have to go back. It was year three or year four. We did just under 12, it was like 11.8 million. And we'd actually made $1.5 million EBITDA.
Okay? Wow.
And you know, people were like, eight, you were losing money. How do you add three? And it was the 80-20 process. It was get rid of the noise, adding better, you know, better customers, better work, finding stuff that wasn't profitable and leaning it out. We had, you know, used welding robots. We had, you know, brought our paint system in. So there was some operational things as well, but it was really 80-20. That's our core. That's how we built what we have.
Right. Awesome. That's great. And so then you build it up, and then had you always thought about building it up and selling, or is it just something that somebody came by the store one day and goes, oh, hey, I'll give you X number of dollars, or did you always want to scale it and sell it?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jay. And because we're self-made, I don't know what you want to call it. We're self-driven, self-made. The goal with that company was to build it and ultimately exit. It was not, you know, my kids are 14 and 10. They're going to have to figure it out on themselves, because I'm not leaving them anything. All right. They're going to have to figure it out like Holly and I have figured it out, tongue in cheek. But the goal was, when we bought it, I brought up, you know, Holly and I own 100% of the company the day we bought it. But my partner, Rob, in the business was instrumental, right? He was the key cog. He was the COO of the company. We ultimately added a CFO to the business in 2017, who became, again, very vested interest in the future of the company, right? So those guys had a great management team in place, and we knew there was ultimately going to be an exit at some point. Trying to figure out when that was, you know, what revenue numbers, what EBITDA, you know the drill, and how big we could get it with our own personal balance sheet. By the end of 19, we had paid the business off. We had about $400,000 of term debt left on a powder coat system. So everything else inside the company had been paid for, even though we'd borrowed another $2 million along the way to grow, you know, paint system, robots, et cetera. Very capital intensive business. And so the belief was, hey, when we think it's the right time in the market, the company set up, right, management team, we would exit the company. That was always the plan from day one. And the key executives were tied into that same program.
Right, right. So did it take you longer than you thought, or?
Yeah. There are days in there, I don't know if it would ever happen. So you can ask, you know. I think this, you know, in that process, in the sale process, I learned a lot. And I would tell you, a lot of private equity firms, they say 3 to 5 years, but the reality, most more 7 to 8. And that's what it takes. For us, the key to the timing was eight and a half years. There were two big keys. Number one, we had grown it to where we had added a second plant again. So after, you know, closing one plant, bringing it on to one roof, we grew it. So we went and added a second plant. And that was great. The growth was great. We had a managed team. We could, you know, put a plant manager over there. It was a young man that we had grown and developed. So it was a great opportunity for him. But it got to the point where the next chunk of growth, Jay, was going to be another probably 8 to 10 million in capital. Expanding the building, second paint line, more lasers. And again, we're self-made people. I don't have a rich uncle sitting somewhere that's writing checks. So the idea for Holly and I, I'm just being candid with you, was not, hey, we're not trying to go bet the farm again. We built this. It's a valuable asset. It's a great business. And so that was half of the equation, was the personal side for us. We just didn't want to double down again. We'd risked it all once, and that was good.
That's great.
The second part was, you know, my management team is they're still there today, number two and number three at the acquiring company. They were rock solid. And so, you know, the growth rate and the trajectory was there. So we went to market, and you'll love this. We went to market, you know, Q1 of 2020. I'm not sure if anybody told you, you know, but there was a global pandemic somewhere in about the end of Q1. So as good as the business was performing, as profitable was, everything was running, that, you know, the IOIs were coming in, and then of course everything just stops, right?
Oh, so, wow, for you guys too.
For us, yeah.
You're because in, your business
in our
well.
Business, we didn't have negative $30 oil one day, but what we did have was safer at home orders all over the country, which really shut the economy down. And so we couldn't get parts, right? We were deemed an essential business as a manufacturer. We made critical components for many industries. So we were deemed essential. But with safer at home orders in effect in various areas, it was just a matter of time till we ran our supply chain out. So we ended up shutting down for a couple of weeks when we ran out of parts. You know, things started back up in May, and the M&A process as well. So the business stopped. The M&A, nobody was buying anything, right? It was, hey, we don't even know what the heck the world's going to look like. Nobody can be in the country, et cetera. So we, though, snapped back very, very strong. And so while it was a very scary time for many business owners, Q2 of 2020 in the COVID quarters, we called it, things did snap back and supply chains turned back on and we were able to get going. So Q3, we had a great forecast for what the rest of the year was going to look like. We had, we were running very, very efficiently at the time and made the decision, okay, let's go back into our process. The number's not going to be as good as we wanted and had hoped, but it's still going to be a great exit, a very successful one for all the key shareholders and stakeholders in the business. And so we entered into an agreement. I think we signed the LOI in August, so late into here, middle of Q3 of 2020, and closed in December. Great buyer. They were an equity-backed strategic acquirer and a wonderful CEO, so they didn't need me. And they loved our management team and our customer list and, in the business. So that's how it all went down. We closed December 14 of 2020. And, again, Holly and I own a fair amount of real estate, so we kept both manufacturing plants. So we're still tied to the business. We're still very vested in the future. We're just not invested in the company.
Right. So you own the real estate.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, coupon link gives you enough. You got to keep up with real estate. You got to keep up with what's going on and gives you something to do, hang out.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And right now, actually, it's funny. Here we are 6 months later. We're actually working on an expansion on the one plant for them because they were growing. They've kept the trajectory of the business going. The team was set up. It's one of those very successful stories where, the day the buyer closes, everything has continued sort of up and to the right. And so we're going to put we're very close to putting a 63,000 square foot expansion on for them. And they're going to, obviously lease that and keep growing the business. And that's great for the community. It's great for us. It's great for the people that bought it. That's the win-win. So yeah. It's fun to stay connected to it, but not be there day to day.
Right. Exactly. Because it's like, a lot of companies now are buying the real estate, but then they're selling the real estate, leasing it back. So I guess that's kind of what they're doing. They're not really interested in real estate long term. They're more interested in that earnings and sales and making money off the split or whatever it is,
Especially manufacturing. There's a lot of equipment, a lot of automation that can, with the labor shortage in this country right now, it's very, very hard to find. As a state, I use it locally. I think as a state, we're under 4% in Wisconsin, but here in Ottawa County, we're at 3.5% unemployment. That's full employment. I know nationally they're, just under 6, but our economy here is very, very, very strong. And so they want to invest their money in more welding robots, automation, right? As they grow, they still need people. Don't get me wrong. They're always going to have human beings at the heart of manufacturing, but they want to put their money there. They don't want it tied up in buildings and dirt, right? They'll let people like us own that and coupon flip.
Yeah, that's great. So what's next? What's in 5 years for Alex and Holly?
That might be the first question you asked that I don't have the answer to, Jay. everyone that I have talked to, even pre-sale and after, and Tiger and another group I've been called YPO, said, take a year off. Eight and a half years, I shared with you some of the tough moments. It always sounds great after the exit. These are fun to do. But there were some tough years. There was nights I slept on the couch, coming home. My wife goes, man, tell me how great it's going, but I haven't seen any return on it. She was growing her second company, and she scaled that pretty tremendously. We had a young family. I put on 40 pounds and, probably lost a bunch of hair along the way too. So it's been a good, about halfway through it, a good year just to reflect, to, reengage with my kids. You and I talked, we both have daughters that play volleyball, traveling all over the country this past spring and summer. She and I have had just a wonderful time together. Look, I'm 43. There will be hopefully more things, right? Right now, the economy's hitting on all cylinders. There's no value to be had. I shared with you the number one deal we bought was we thought we were buying it really right. You can't buy anything right now. And so I think it's been a great year to sit on the sidelines. But I'm not done. I can't, as I told my daughter, I can do this for 6 months. I can't do it for the next 6 years.
Well, it's like, all right. So who fought Saturday night in Vegas? The big McGregor.
Yeah.
Or they were saying, the guy didn't need the money. So it's going to be hard for him to fight at such a high level and win in such a big match, like that. It's not an easy, that's one of the hardest fights you'll ever do is MMA, right? MMA.
Yeah, you got it. Yep, so MMA. I think that portrays to what you and I do. And that is, do I want to ever go risk it all again? No,
right.
But I won't. But right. if I don't, how hungry will I be? I mean, I would go in some mornings at 2-3 in the morning because I couldn't sleep because we had to solve. I mean, you're just driven, right? And I'm not an ex-military Marine, but as an athlete, the early morning. I mean, if I'm not in a situation where everything that I have is at risk, how driven can you? So Holly and I have spent some time thinking about that. You know, I mean, it's weird to think about, but when you're used to it all being on the line every day, I don't know. I don't think I could just be a sitting CEO from a, you know, from a family business going from second to third generation, or I, you know, that's not for me. It's either got to be a big turnaround or something that's hyper growth where you just immerse yourself in it. And it's all you think about it, you know, and or
you don't.
The team and yeah.
Or you don't. I mean, I know there's a guy that I spoke to a minute ago, Tiger guy, and he's out of Rhode Island, and he gets up in the mornings and he works out and he reads the papers and he just kind of hangs out at his, he's got a 5 o'clock, you know, country club he goes to for drinks. And then the next day, I mean, it does that. That's what he does. But if you want to really immerse yourself into something and you want to win big, you got to gamble big or you got to put it all in. And is that something that you really want to put yourself and your family through and all that stuff? Because why? You know, it's like, man, don't want to go through all that.
That's right. And at the end of the day, never having to work again ever. It's all about what do you want to do with it and be driven. But I think a lot about it. I think people that are successful do, especially at a younger age. I go to the gym at 5 a.m. I take the kids to school, but I can't go to the country club sitting at a cog. I drive myself nuts. My liver would be gone in 40 years, right? It sounds great. It's funny. I'll tell you a quick story. When said, I like to play golf. I'm not very good, but I like to do it. We have two country club memberships, and at the two clubs, it's July 13th today. I have a total of 0 rounds of golf at either country club in, and I don't have a job. Okay.
So
no excuse. And so I laugh when people say, that's what I want to do. Retire. It looks like, I just know that's not for me, but I think about how can you, what's next? And the thing of how can you all in totally committed without maybe risking everything? And I don't know. It's an interesting question. I don't have the answer to it yet, but that's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. I thought about that in Vegas. Cause we just spent 6 days in Vegas, you know, we were there. I guess you were there. We're pretty much the same time, I guess. Yeah. You know, our daughter's volleyball, and I was thinking about going to the crap table and the blackjack table, and I'm thinking, man, do I really want to win big? Because if I got to win big, I got to risk a lot, you know. And I didn't want to do that 6 nights in a row.
That's right. We put $200 on the Milwaukee Bucks, and I was biting my nails at $200, Jay. So how's that?
Man, I tell you what, y'all are looking pretty good coming back.
Yeah,
back on Phoenix.
It's been fun here in Wisconsin. But just to your point, you know, you have an 8-figure exit. It's like, what, you know, but a $200 bet on Giannis and the team. So,
oh, yeah, man, unbelievable. All right. So, last question. What would you tell your 20-year-old self? You've heard that kind of question before. If you were going through school and is there anything that you would have, anything that you wish that you would have done differently or anything that you would tell yourself?
I wouldn't have done anything differently along the way. We played Division II college sports. I graduated both my and I debt free by getting half athletic, half academic. I believe that kids that are committed that achieve that would never have changed. It was some of the fondest memories of my life. What I would do a little bit differently, Jay, what I would tell anyone else, my 20-year-old self, build your network. You know, growing up in a household, my teacher, you know, the network was the school and the team and the town, and it was rural, you know, we were a relatively small town. Then, you know, my seventh grade English teacher made a comment, I'll never forget it. Alex, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And if I learned one thing in 12 years, 13 years of school before college, that was it. The world is a huge place, and people are out there that genuinely want to help. And if they can bring value, they will. But along the way of those 8.5 years of building the company, there were a number of times where the YPO network, other affiliations that I have, helped us make a big step up in the business. It was drive on the part of myself and my team, but build your network. Always take the meeting, always take the coffee, write the handwritten thank you note. There is great value. It's not always immediate. You know, today they all want to look at their phone and know, am I good? Am I winner or loser today? Right. But over time, those relationships, that network is.
Oh, that's great. You're exactly right. Yeah. So we've had Bob Bodine on my show several times. He's a good friend. Has been for years, but he wrote the book Power of Who, The Power of Who, Bob Bodine, incredible guy. Also wrote Two Chairs, but anyway, The Power of Who, but he talks about how your network is your net worth. You know, and I've heard that several times too. And that's exactly right, man. The smarter people you have, the better off you are, the more people you can reach out to talk about what's going on and all that stuff. And people genuinely want to help you. They do. They want to be very, very helpful. And but you got to reach out to them and talk to them about it, you know.
So you got
to
get over the nerves, Jay, right? I don't know if, you know, I won't give you local successful names here, but my wife and I were we weren't even married. And we would call these people and go look at buildings with them, and they would take the time. And we just had that. And so I think if I would have started that younger, that is, I'd give it to any advice to anyone or my 20-year-old self. Got to do that. It also builds great skills in just getting uncomfortable, right? Reaching out to people. Maybe they don't all return phone calls. Most of them do, and most of them are absolutely willing to help.
Yeah, no, exactly right. That's perfect. That is absolutely perfect. I love that a lot. I love that a lot because you're right. You're right. People do care. They love you. They want to help you. They're good people, man. They're good people. They put their clothes on just like everybody else, and one leg at a time, or whatever they say in that. But that's great.
And they've all got problems. We've all got. I mean, it's amazing. We think of these Bezos and these wildly successful people. Some of you met, I met. They go, they got problems. They got problems like you and I do. That old rap song? More money, more problems. I mean, they got problems. They got to, you know, figure it out. And so I think that there's a common thought around a lot of young entrepreneurs, or they haven't done or built a business yet, is, boy, I want to be like that person. They got problems just like you and I have. I will assure you of that. And so when you go to them and you talk to them and you approach them, they're willing to help. And 95% of the instances that I can relate to, they're willing to help.
Right.
People absolutely. Help them. People help them along the way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They've got mentors. I mean, they just didn't think of it themselves, and all of a sudden they're successful, turn out overnight. No, they had people that they talked to, that they reached out to. They had help. Exactly. I'm 100%. That is awesome. All right, everybody. Hey, Alex Kowalski, thank you so much for being on the show today. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. That is so good. I met you a couple of months ago on our Tiger, and I really enjoyed getting to know you more, and I want to make sure that we stay in touch. I want to have you back on the show again. Give me some more ideas about how to connect, how to grow your network.
I love it. I love it, Jay. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a ton of fun today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Alex. Have you on again. Thank you.
All right.